This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Now listen to this. You are listening to AWOL Radio on CKMS The Sound 100.3 FM in Waterloo. We are also podcasting on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca, and you can find AWOL on the web at peaceculture.org.
Neil was 17 in a group home for B&E, was in AA but had been drinking on the night that he and Jason knocked on doors, rang some bells, looking for a friend. The cops were called, the boys split up. 15 minutes later, Jason saw Neil handcuffed and bleeding in the back of the cruiser, screaming, looking scared. Help me, they're gonna kill me. One shoe. Neil's body was discovered 5 days later on the outskirts. Jason gave two statements to police, but they weren't taken. The death deemed accidental, the official version being that Neil Stonechild was on his way to turning himself in to an adult penitentiary at minus 28 degrees with one shoe. Inquiry was launched 12 years later after Rodney Naismith froze to death and Lawrence Wegner froze to death and Lloyd Dusty Horn froze to death and Daryl Knight almost did but lived to prove abduction and abandonment were common practice. Still, the original case files concerning Neil were lost in renovations. RCMP investigations failed to find evidence for prosecution. So in a cloud of suspicion, the hearings start October. Neil's mother just wants closure. Watch you
in Montreal.
Child was a painter and a wrestler, and I think he would have liked this one. Must have lost it running, should have tied the laces. It symbolizes something, mistakes, empty spaces, getting chased. Watch you. Watch you. Watch you.
AWOL Radio here on 100.3 Sound FM, soundfm.ca, 100.3 FM in Waterloo region, CKMS. This is Smash State Report here on AWOL Radio. Check out AWOL Radio on the web, AWOL Radio's podcast on rabble.ca, also on the Grand River MC.ca, part of the Rabble Podcast Network and the Grand River Media Collective. Hopping right into the Smash State Report, and this is the Dominion Media Co-op's February in Review. The movement for sanctuary cities experienced a historic win in Toronto, where City Council strengthened its commitment to providing services to all residents regardless of immigration status, without fear of detention or deportation. Hamilton City Councillor Brian McHattie said he will pursue a similar policy in Hamilton. A few dozen people occupied the Citizenship and Immigration Building in Vancouver to honor Kurdish-Iranian refugee Hossein Bloujani and demand a public investigation into the cause of his death. Canadian Doctors for Refugee Care and the Canadian Association of Refugee Lawyers launched a federal court case against the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration in an attempt to prove that last year's changes to refugee health care under the Interim Federal Health Care Program are unconstitutional. Longtime Toronto resident Israel Sanchez was deported to Panama. He fled the country in 1988 due to state repression and became active in the city's queer and HIV communities. Sanchez was unaware of an outstanding deportation order until border agents showed up on his doorstep earlier this year. LGBT groups expressed concern over the creation of a federal Office of Religious Freedom to promote religious freedoms as part of Canadian foreign policy. Others noted that Harper's inaugural remarks focus on persecution in Muslim-majority countries. The Supreme Court ruled that Canada's hate speech laws are constitutionally valid, limit on freedom of expression, and there's more on that one. A new professional national basketball team announced its name would be the Ottawa Tomahawks, hours later after swift public reaction denouncing the choice as racist, the name was dropped. From forums out west to rallies out east, Idle No More events and actions continued across the country. In Saskatoon, demonstrators disrupted a meeting between First Nations chiefs and federal officials about education to protest a lack of consultation. More than 50 youth walked from Jackhead First Nation and other Manitoba First Nations in Winnipeg to protest Bill C-45. Cree youth continued the journey of Nishiyu from Wapmagushtui in northern Quebec to Ottawa. The 22nd annual Women's Memorial March took place in Vancouver and in cities across the country to honor missing and murdered Indigenous women and demand justice. The RCMP questioned the numbers cited by Indigenous and women's organizations, alleging the force is not aware of the 500 cases. Human Rights Watch released a report about RCMP policing in northern BC, detailing cases of rape, assault, harassment, and other abuse by officers against First Nations women and girls. In Edmonton, an 18-year-old First Nation girl revealed that when police responded to a call concerning her rape, she was arrested instead. A rape kit was not performed for 3 days and she was not able to shower for 5 days. An investigation got underway in BC after Burnaby RCMP shot and killed Ryan Jacobs, the son of Squamish Nation hereditary chief and elected band counselor Gibby Jacob. Demonstrators gathered outside the Grand Valley Institution Women's Prison in Kitchener to show support for the imprisoned women and to demand justice for the deaths of Ashley Smith and Canute James. The Ontario Coalition Against Poverty disrupted a city council meeting in Toronto and promised an occupation in March unless the city opens more shelter beds and space. Bill C-400, a private member's bill calling for a national housing strategy to deal with the housing and homelessness crisis in Canada, was defeated by Conservatives despite widespread support from housing activists across the country. A campaign for social housing was launched in BC. Downtown Eastside residents and allies continued daily picket actions outside the new upscale Pigeon restaurant, protesting gentrification in the neighborhood despite Vancouver police harassment of organizers. The impacts of a new Halifax Regional Police crime mapping website on safety, prejudice, and victim blaming were called into question. And you can check out more on that one on dominion.mediacoop.ca. And this is the February in review. And we'll get into this next one a little bit more. But New York resident Joel Bitar was arrested on 26 charges related to the 2010 G20 protests in Toronto. He faces extradition to Canada. A massive demonstration against an official education summit in Montreal was quickly declared illegal. Police broke up the demonstration after they said they were pelted with snowballs and ice. They responded with flashbangs, baton strikes, pepper spray, and rubber bullets. Inside the summit, the Quebec government announced tuition fees will be increased yearly at approximately 3%, ending the tuition fee freeze that was the principal subject of last year's months-long student strike. Earlier in the month, more than 30 people were arrested at Montreal demonstrations against the Quebec government's Plan Nord. In early February, Attawapiskat community members blockaded an access road to nearby De Beers Diamond Mine. A few days after the first action ended, a second blockade was established. The mining company turned to the courts to seek an injunction. Vancouver-based mining company Pacific Booker Minerals announced that it will sue the BC government for its denial of a permit for the company's Morrison Lake Gold and Copper Project. Victims of rape and murder at a Guatemalan mine are now able to sue Hudbay Minerals in Canadian courts after the Canadian mining company abruptly abandoned its legal argument that the lawsuit should not be heard in Canada. And we'll have more on that on the Smash the State report. The Quebec government announced it is considering a broad consultation on uranium mining in the province. Anti-nuclear protesters and Idle No More activists held a day of action against the General Electric Hitachi Uranium Processing Plant in Toronto, blockading a CP line. Plans by the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission were revealed that would see liquid bomb-grade uranium transported by armed convoy from Chalk River Laboratories Nuclear Research Facility in Ontario to South Carolina for reprocessing. Meanwhile, in Saskatchewan, First Nations leaders, elders, and grassroots activists spoke out against nuclear waste storage at a series of sessions hosted by the Nuclear Waste Management Organization and the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations. Journalists obtained documents revealing collaboration between the Assembly of First Nations and the RCMP in response to the 2007 Day of Action protests. And in Guatemala, former dictator and retired General Efrain Rios Montt and his intelligence chief José Mauricio Rodríguez Sánchez are on trial for genocide in the Lillooksel region in the 1980s. A court in Haiti ordered former dictator Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier to appear in a human rights case. The United Nations accused of causing a cholera outbreak that killed more than 7,000 people and made hundreds of thousands of people sick rejected compensation to the victims. A C-17 Canadian Air Force transport plane will continue to provide logistical support to French troops in Mali due to the approval of a one-month extension. A public opinion poll indicated that most Canadians would oppose the deployment of combat troops to the country. And finally, the deployment of zombie troops wasn't a popular decision either. The Quebec government canceled its plans to use a hypothetical zombie attack to test emergency preparedness at a civil security symposium in favor of a flood scenario. But not to worry, Foreign Affairs Minister John Barrett assured the House of Commons that Canada would never be a safe haven for zombies, forgetting to remark just for murderous bankers and mining executives. Now, that was the February month in review from the Media Co-op, mediacoop.ca. We're going to jump into a piece that extends from one of those, and it's a piece from Free Speech Radio News put together by Aaron Lakoff. Check it out. It's called Students in Quebec Boycott Government Meeting and Push for Free Tuition.
Today, students protested outside a government-led summit on post-secondary education. The summit was held to determine the future of public university financing in the province of Quebec and comes in the wake of historic student strikes last year, which brought more than 300,000 students to the streets at its peak. While the provincial government assembled 350 people inside the summit to try to reach consensus on the issue, one of the major student federations boycotted the meeting, saying what the government is offering isn't enough. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has more from Montreal.
This week's summit on higher education was a campaign promise made by the ruling Parti Québécois government. After party leader Pauline Marois won the provincial election last September, she overturned the proposed 75% tuition increase of the previous government under Jean Charest. She also promised to bring various actors together at a summit in an attempt to reach a consensus on the future for funding of public universities and colleges. The summit focused on four major themes: education quality, accessibility, institutional governance, and research. Among the 350 participants were university administrators, corporate lobbyists, and student unions. However, not everyone in the education sector was at the table. The militant student federation ASSE, which has 70,000 members, decided to boycott the summit. Jeremy Bédard-Vine, a spokesperson for ASSE, explains why. This week's summit on higher education was a campaign promise made by the ruling Parti Québécois government. After party leader Pauline Marois won the provincial election last September, she overturned the proposed 75% tuition increase of the previous government under Jean Charest. She also promised to bring various actors together at a summit in an attempt to reach a consensus on the future for funding of public universities and colleges. The summit focused on four major themes: education quality, accessibility, institutional governance, and research. Among the 350 participants were university administrators, corporate lobbyists, and student unions. However, not everyone in the education sector was at the table. The militant student federation ASSE, which has 70,000 members, decided to boycott the summit. Jeremy Bédard-Vine, a spokesperson for ASSE, explains why.
The summit was not to look at the government's economic choices. And for us, this was not something that we wanted to attach ourselves to. We could not legitimize the conclusions of that summit, especially as the government had made it clear that they wanted one position in terms of student contribution to be adopted from that summit, indexing tuition to the cost of living. This is not something that we fought for in the last year. We did not do 6 months of strike for that, for another tuition hike, no matter how small it is. We want the government to take steps towards progressively installing free education and the government to respect its progressive engagements instead of constantly going back on them.
The SA Student Union held a demonstration outside the conference center to call for free university education. Around 1,000 people protested on Monday as well, as some protesters attempted to access the site where the summit was being held, but were prevented by riot police. Two people were arrested. Following meetings on Monday, Marois announced that the government would indeed be raising the cost of tuition by 3% to match the increase in the cost of living. This amounts to $70 per year per student, bringing tuition fees to approximately $2,100 US per year. There are nearly 300,000 full-time university students in Quebec, and the government funds approximately $7,000 in education costs per student. But representatives of university administrations say that's still not enough, and the funding shortfall amounts to $2,500 per student. Pierre Duchesne is Quebec's Minister of Higher Education.
The student associations must understand that they have to accept to contribute to education through a financial effort, and to prevent repeated crises like we've seen in the last few years, that effort must be stable, and we're studying the options, notably indexation.
While Quebec's various student federations do not share common political mandates around the summit, all of them are against a tuition increase. Julien Villeneuve, a college philosophy professor and member of the group Professors Against the Hike, responds to the idea of tuition indexation.
So I think the refined answer is probably, yeah, you know, probably $50 a year, you know, won't if there's bursaries to compensate, probably won't make a difference. But it's still a step in the wrong direction. You know, it's fine for next year, it's fine for in 5 years maybe, but if we keep going in that direction, slowly but surely, you know, it won't be fine anymore, right?
During last year's student strike, Villeneuve gained widespread attention when he became better known as Anarcho-Panda, putting on a panda costume to become the student movement's mascot and trying to quell tensions between police and students during the nightly demonstrations in Montreal. Some students say they're upset that official talks are moving forward, yet the government has still not responded to calls for a public inquiry into the police repression that took place during the strike. In total, more than 3,000 people were arrested, many of them non-students as well. Hundreds more were beaten by police, and two students even lost eyes from concussion grenades. Émilie Joly is a law student at the University of Quebec in Montreal, who has been helping to support students facing charges.
The whole moving on process to me would necessarily involve some sort of taking away the accusations, either like through an amnesty proposal or through some sort of judicial power deciding that, you know, these were political detention more than criminal infractions. So the whole moving forward to me involves concrete steps to move forward. And I don't think that we've actually seen that.
There is still no agreement between the different actors at the summit about how to solve the long-term question of university financing in Quebec. In the lead-up to the summit, the Quebec University Rectors and Principals Association issued a statement criticizing the government for the $250 million in cuts to higher education made in this year's budget, saying that this would result in hiring delays and nearly 1,400 layoffs of university employees. As for the students, while there is no talk of another prolonged strike in the near future, 40 associations representing 35,000 students voted for a one-day strike Tuesday, and they're calling on other civil society groups to support them in the coming weeks. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
And that was Aaron Lakoff for Free Speech Radio News. And jumping into more here on the Smash Estate Report, Toronto G20 state repression goes international with the arrest and request for extradition of the American activist. Yes, we're talking about the 2010 Toronto G20 summit in June 2010. This arrest on Thursday, February 14th at 6 o'clock in the morning, federal marshals arrested an American activist, Joel Bitar, in his New York home on a provisional arrest warrant issued by the U.S. Attorney's Office, acting on a foreign extradition request from Canadian authorities. The complaint against Joel cites 26 counts, almost all relating to property damage that occurred during the G20 summit protests in Toronto, Ontario, in June 2010. After a temporary delay in court proceedings due to an outbreak of lice in the federal prison where Joel and many others have the misfortune of being held the weekend and a national holiday on Monday, Joel went before Magistrate Judge Gabriel W. Gorstein on Tuesday, February 19th, to determine whether he would be granted bail as he awaits extradition hearing in the United States. During the proceedings, a general timeline of the actions of the Canadian U.S. authorities was established. Joel was arrested in Toronto along with a little over 1,100 other people during the 2010 protests on June 26 and 27, 2010, in what is thought to be the largest mass arrest in Canadian history. Joel was processed and released without any charges. In December 2010, lead investigator Sergeant Gary Giroux, who stole my backpack, announced to various Canadian news agencies that Canada was seeking the extradition of three Americans for damages amounting to $500,000. Soon after, Joel retained the services of an attorney, Martin Stoller, who contacted Giroux. According to Stoller's testimony on Tuesday, Giroux confirmed that Joel was a suspect and they were investigating him on charges relating to property destruction. The assistant U.S. attorney said that the original complaint against Joel, which details the charges, was prepared in October 2011. Canadian authorities then spent some time going through their image and video database from the G20, as well as obtaining Facebook posts that Joel allegedly made regarding the G20 summit in Canada, and submitted a request for extradition in October 2012, which jump-started a winding process involving the U.S. Embassy in Washington, the State Department, and the Justice Department's Office of International Affairs. It is worth noting that in this time period, beginning in December 2010 until his arrest in February 2013, Joel traveled overseas several times and was not arrested, although he was stopped by the Department of Homeland Security and questioned. Joel's response was that they should speak to his lawyer. Establishing this timeline of events took the longest part of the proceedings, and there was much back and forth between the assistant U.S. attorney, who opposed bail, pressed U.S. legal obligations in respect to treaties with Canada, and claimed that the allegations against Joel, which mostly relate to property damage, are extraditable offenses that endangered Canadian citizens. And Joel's current attorney, Philip Weinstein, who argued several special circumstances, such as delay, the political nature of the charges, the community ties, that allow for bail in extradition cases. After some consideration, Judge Gorstein granted bail on the basis of a special circumstance of delay. It had been over 2 years since Sergeant Giroux had spoken with Martin Stoller and alleged Joel's involvement, and also acknowledged Joel's low risk of flight. The stipulations of the bail are steep. Joel was granted bail to the tune of $500,000, a little tit-for-tat, as well as house arrest with electronic monitoring. He was released into the custody of his parents on Wednesday, February 20th. His next court date, which is his actual extradition hearing, is currently scheduled for March 20th. For those who may be unfamiliar, the G20 is a collection of finance ministers and central bank governors from 19 powerful countries plus the European Union, along with representatives of international financial institutions at the G20 summits. These figures are joined by top politicians to discuss their ongoing exploitation of the planet and its resources. Downtown Toronto was placed under heavy police control during the summit, and protesters were arbitrarily arrested and held in a large film studio that was converted into a prison, specifically for the purpose of crushing dissent. It is well known that many were brutalized, insulted, or sexually humiliated by Canadian police, outraging large sectors of Canadian society, not enough of us. Protest organizers were attacked by the police in their homes, arrested and charged for attending meetings and discussing protest plans. The extradition of a protester for property damage is almost unprecedented in the histories of both the United States and Canada. Considering that state repression has been ratcheted even higher in both countries over the past several years, this latest development comes with little surprise. Governments claim that property damage somehow endangers the lives of citizens. All the while, their police and military forces brutalize and kill people at home and abroad that they deem undesirable or non-citizens. As long as there are states and international summits of states, there will be protests and revolt by the non-citizens of the world. We are in solidarity with Joel Bitar, who is a friend, a son, a nephew, a Palestine solidarity activist, a co-worker, a prospective nursing student, and a real person whose life cannot be categorized so easily into the familiar tropes. The U.S. and the Canadian governments want to call him a criminal and eventually an inmate. We fight this legal process and will support Joel throughout his predicament. Joel's case may be unique, but state repression is not. We are in solidarity with all comrades who face state repression, especially those in jail from G20 protest charges in Canada and the Pacific Northwest grand jury resistors here in the U.S. And check out supportjoel.com for more on that. And Joel's case is no longer unique, as today, well, today it was reported or found and posted on the Vancouver Media Co-op. Thanks, Indie Van. More G20 state repression. Dane Rossman in federal custody. Early on the morning of Thursday, February 21st, U.S. Marshals arrested Dane Rossman at his home in Tucson, Arizona, on a provisional arrest warrant issued by the U.S. Attorney's Office acting on a Canadian extradition request. Dane is one of five Americans sought in Canada for alleged offenses stemming from the G20 summit in Toronto. On June 26th and 27th, 2010, tens of thousands of individuals gathered in Toronto to protest the G20 summit. G20 is a group of finance ministers and central bank governors from 19 powerful countries plus the European Union. During the 2010 summit, Canadian authorities specifically targeted people involved in migrant justice, Indigenous solidarity, and anarchist organizing for prosecution. Dane was arrested along with over 1,100 other people in the largest mass arrest in Canada's history. He was processed and released without charges. Now, 3 years later, he is facing three charges related to alleged property damage. Dane is a dedicated social justice advocate, humanitarian, aid volunteer, and student. He has spent the past several years in Arizona providing humanitarian relief on the U.S.-Mexico border and organizing against racist profiling laws and mass incarceration. The extradition of an individual from the U.S. to Canada for property damage is almost unheard of. Dane's extradition is political in nature because it is meant to create fear and criminalize dissent. As long as global institutions exploit our communities for profit, people will cross nation-state boundaries to protest and make known the suffering in their home communities. Dane is currently being held at the Federal Corrections Corporation of America facility in Florence, Arizona, a private prison where most of his fellow inmates are being held on immigration-related offenses. As Dane's supporters and friends, we extend solidarity to all those who face state repression, those in prison due to the G20 protest charges, and those incarcerated for crossing nation-state boundaries. Dane has an extradition hearing set for April 16, 2013. Check his support website for further updates, and please consider donating to his legal defense fund. And that's supportdanerossman.blogspot. And we gotta go to a song before the next piece gets read. And might as well play the song 2010, Problem This City's Got, from Cambridge, AWOL Radio. We'll be right back. And that was Cambridge with 2010, the problem this city's got. AWOL Radio here, Smash the State Report. It is the 1st of March. It's a little 4:30 in the afternoon. And we're hopping to a piece that was posted up on rabble.ca. Came across it on mostlyatwater.org. Tom Flanagan was one of Stephen Harper's key mentors and remains perhaps the most influential ideologue of the current conservative movement, the movement that's in power in Ottawa right now. This piece is called Tom Flanagan is Now Person Non Grata, but His Ideology Lives On, posted by Carl Nirenberg yesterday. You can get some sense of Flanagan's ideology in his many articles and speeches and in his books, especially Waiting for the Wave, the Reform Party and the Conservative Movement, which was originally published in 1997, but reissued in an updated version last year. Flanagan, who is originally from the United States and is a leading member of the neoconservative Calgary School, has written most extensively on Aboriginal matters. He has argued that most Aboriginal militancy is manufactured by the Aboriginal industry, the army of consultants and advisors who egg on the Aboriginal leadership and profit from the ongoing conflict between Aboriginal and mainstream societies. Yeah, that's him. It is a fairly dark and conspiratorial theory and takes little account of the concrete, current, and historic realities of Aboriginal Canada. But that's Flanagan for you. He has also advocated for property rights on First Nation reserves, but has to be given credit on that front for a willingness to modify his initial hard line after being exposed to former Kamloops chief Manny Jules' much more nuanced position. Jules is the chief advocate in Canada for First Nations property rights. He favors a tailored system suited to Aboriginal history and culture, not a reproduction of the majority colonial society's fee simple system. Flanagan has admitted publicly that he has learned much from Jules that changed his view on the complex issue, an issue he once believed was oh so simple. He has not shown similar open-mindedness on much else, like children. The essence of Harper's mentor's political philosophy, if one could call it a philosophy, owes as much to Machiavelli as it does to any of the philosophic heroes of the New Right, going back to Adam Smith and his famous Invisible Hand. Flanagan's goal has been to get the Conservatives to understand that they must reinvent Canada, not merely govern it. And they have to do this in the face of the fact that even if Canadians might put the Conservatives in power, thanks to the first-past-the-post electoral system, those same Canadians are still soft, spoiled, and socialistic. Canadians, Flanagan believes, must, like children who don't know what's good for them, be gently but firmly led to the brisk, embracing Conservative promised land. Indeed, Harper's mentor harbors an attitude towards his adopted country that is not dissimilar to that of the colonizers on a civilizing and Christianizing mission towards the benighted and unschooled natives. It is no use trying to reason with the spoiled and recalcitrant welfare state clients that Canadians are, Flanagan has argued. The way to remake Canada, Flanagan teaches, is through behavior modification. His central message, change the rules of the game and change the incentives of the systems, we will change the people of this country. The tactic of resorting to stealth to get the Conservative Party's main legislative agenda through Parliament, see Omnibus C-38 and C-45, comes either directly or indirectly from Flanagan. As well, Flanagan's ideology is behind the end of the per capita subsidy to political parties, the raising of the minimum age for old age security, the draconian tightening of employment insurance rules for seasonal workers, and the virtual elimination of environmental hearings for energy projects. In the last case, the Flanagan ideology reasons that if First Nations environmentalists and other do-gooder ne'er-do-wells are deprived of a platform, their voices, like Bishop Berkeley's tree in the forest, will echo in futile silence. Fund your friends, starve your critics. In fact, Flanagan has been most sympathetic in advocating that the Conservatives should defund all those liberal friends in civil society. Stop giving taxpayer dollars, he has said, to the array of non-governmental organizations that work on the environment, social justice, international development, and women's and children's issues, some likely raising concerns over sexual exploitation of children. Flanagan has argued that liberal governments spend public funds to subsidize their political allies in civil society, even if some of those supposed allies use some of the money to quite harshly criticize the liberals. in the view of Flanagan and the Harper conservatives, tolerating that sort of criticism is symptomatic of a sort of masochistic pathology among liberals and provincially where they have been in power among NDPers. The conservatives have been blunt about not funding anyone who in any way openly disagrees with any aspect of their program. And they have even gone further. They have worked harder to steer funds to their ideological soulmates and friends among evangelicals, regardless of what those friends may have to say about homosexuality. You can find the most thorough elaboration of the Flanagan philosophy in a book by two up-and-coming young Canadian neocons, Tasha Kiridin and Adam Dafala, Rescuing Canada's Right, Blueprint for a Conservative Revolution. The two up-and-comers are big Flanagan fans. This is what Dafala had to say about Flanagan in a review of the updated version of Waiting for the Wave last summer. Other than Stephen Harper, no person is as qualified as Tom Flanagan to offer an insider's perspective on the Reform Party, its reincarnation as the Conservative Party, and what has transpired since then. As a Reform activist and staffer, he worked closely with Preston Manning for 2 years. And as the occupant of several important roles in the Canadian Alliance and Conservatives, including election campaign manager in 2004, the University of Calgary's professor's perch has been unique. Flanagan, rather overly frank comments on child pornography may have pushed him off that unique perch. But Flanagan's ideology is very much alive and well and living in the halls of power in Ottawa. And, well, why is Tom Flanagan now a person non grata, you might be asking? Well, Carl Nirenberg didn't really explain it in that article that was posted up on Ravel. But Tom Flanagan has basically taken a extreme libertarian position on child pornography. He has stated that he doesn't find fault with people looking at it, since looking at it doesn't cause any injury. Of course, that ignores the fact that to look at child pornography has to be produced, and producing child pornography abuses a child. You can find more. There's a huge firestorm going on Twitter, a twit storm going on, taking Flanagan apart for his ridiculous comments that happened last night. He's been thrown out of his panel at the CBC. He's become a person non grata. He's not welcome anymore. Because of ridiculous, that's individualistic libertarianism at its worst right there. And in perfect Flanagan fashion, it ignores the context of the situation. It ignores the history. It ignores how that child porn was produced. Kind of like he ignores how, our current society has been produced through a genocide. He ignores that when he's talking about his Aboriginal industry and other ridiculous things from Tom Flanagan. Ridiculous. Ridiculous Tom Flanagan. A few updates from the Women's Coordinating Committee for a Free Walmapoo. That's wcctoronto.wordpress.com. And Wiliche Resistance claims actions of sabotage in favor of the Mapuche prisoners of Peel Mikan. In this communique, Wiliche Resistance of Fura Wilmapu announces an escalation of actions to demand the freedom of two Machi, or medicine healers, and four Konas of Pilmaikin jailed in the Lanchuhu prison in Valdiva. To the Mapuche nation and local international public opinion, the Wiliche resistance of the Fura Wilmapu claims the following actions. In Puerto Montt, a roadblock with barricades towards the town of Paragua on a Monday morning in February 2013. Osorno, on the night of Monday, February 18th, 2013, an attack was carried out on the machinery of CESA on the Los Carreras Road between the intersections of Freer and the Pratt. CESA is the hydroelectric company that extracts energy from Pilmaikin and River. Therefore, it is an enemy of the Mapuche people for being an energy company that threatens to flood sacred ceremonial space of Negin Mapu Kintuante and destroy the Pilmaikin River. Also, the night of Monday, February 18th, a cell phone antenna was burned down on the upper rail Rahu Avenue. Valdivia. Roadblock with barricades on the highway that unites Valdivia with Palacio, specifically on the Casablanca bypass. We inform that the Wiliche resistance of Fura Wilimampu initiates an escalation of actions to demand the freedom of the Machi and Peni, of Pilmaikin jailed in the prison in Valdivia. Freedom for all Mapuche political prisoners. Oust the hydroelectric plants. Marichiwu. And to follow up with that, well, in times of war, women destroy the political patriarchal prison system. This is a info night happening in Toronto on Saturday, March 9th, 8 p.m., presenting the exclusive cross-Canada speaking tour of the poet-author Kelly Flugback with the book launch of These Burning Streets. Kelly Flugback was arrested for her alleged role in destroying some Toronto and shattering that illusion just a little bit more. Has recently got out of jail. I think that was today. So she'll be there, as well as international anti-fascist and anti-authoritarian speakers directly from Greece. Check out wcctoronto.wordpress.com for more on that. It's happening at the Graduate Student Union's gym at U of T on March 9th, 8 p.m. next weekend. Also speaking at that event will be Amanda Lickers and George Horton, Nora Buena from Peterborough and the Anarchist Black Cross of Peterborough. Amanda Lickers is an anarcho-indigenous feminist, Onondaga of the Haudenosaunee, anti-authoritarian prison abolitionist on the patriarchal nature of the prison industrial complex. George Horton Nora Buena is a political prisoner recently released on bail pending court appeal, convicted for his alleged participation in the riots during the Toronto G20 in 2010. George, who was sentenced to 10 months imprisonment on September 28th, was released in December after serving just over 2 months of his sentence while his appeal is going through. So again, check that out, wcctoronto.wordpress.com. And this is the Smash the State Report here on AWOL Radio. We're going to go to this next piece from rightsaction.org, and it's a breakthrough regarding legal liability of Canadian mining corporations for abuses overseas. And this was posted up on Monday, the February 25th. It was covered on the Daily Gear. I'm just going to quickly read it, though. And again, this is from rightsaction.com. Canadian civil trial against Hudbay Minerals to proceed in Canadian courts, March 4th, 5th, 2013. There has been a precedent-setting development in the Mayans' lawsuit against Hudbay Minerals over shooting and rapes at the nickel mine site in Guatemala. This is a stunning victory for our clients and paves the way for future lawsuits against Canadian mining companies, said the lawyer Murray Klippenstein. And Rights Action is honored to support the work with the nickel mining harmed communities of eastern Guatemala since 2004, including their efforts to seek justice and remedy in Canadian courts in their three cases against Hudbay Minerals. Thank you to all who have donated funds and otherwise supported their struggle for justice and remedy. In conjunction with the Breaking the Silence Network, Rights Action is bringing one of the plaintiffs, Angela Shock, to Toronto to attend the trial, March 4th and 5th. There will be public events in and around Toronto around that time, and stay on rightsaction.org for more on that. And here is the press release. In an important precedent-setting development for the accountability of Canadian mining companies for alleged overseas human rights abuses, victims of rape and murder at a Guatemalan mine are now able to sue a Canadian mining company in Canadian courts. Guatemalan Mayan villagers who are suing Canadian mining company Hudbay Minerals for the alleged gang rapes of 11 women, the killing of community leader Adolfo Ich, and the shooting of and paralyzing of German Schub at Hudbay's former mining project in Guatemala, recently learned that Hudbay has abruptly abandoned its legal argument that the lawsuit should not be heard in Canada just before an Ontario court was set to determine the issue. As a result, and for the first time, a lawsuit against a Canadian mining company over alleged human rights abuses abroad will be heard in Canadian courts. This is a stunning victory for human rights and paves the way for future lawsuits against Canadian mining companies, said Murray Klippenstein, lawyer for the Mayan plaintiffs. Continuing, corporations be warned. This case clearly shows that Canadian companies can be sued in Canadian courts for alleged human rights atrocities committed at their foreign operations. Hud Bay had filed extensive legal briefs arguing that the lawsuit should be heard in Guatemala, not Canada, despite overwhelming evidence indicating that Guatemala's justice system is dysfunctional, making it impossible for the victims to get justice there. According to the United Nations, Guatemala is one of the world's most violent countries officially at peace. According to Human Rights Watch, 99.75% of violent crime in Guatemala goes unpunished due to corruption and intimidation and attacks against judges and witnesses. Quote, Hud Bay fought Angelica Rosa and their co-plaintiffs tooth and nail on this issue for over a year, forcing survivors of rape to travel to Toronto to ensure extensive cross-examination and forcing us to spend countless hours compiling stacks of evidence, expert reports, and witness testimony, said Murray Klippenstein. Quote, now the defendant's legal resistance on this key point has collapsed. Rosa, Margarita, and their co-plaintiffs should be praised for the courage and determination they have shown through this difficult process, unquote. While this development effectively removes the legal argument that the case cannot be heard in Canada, other hurdles facing the Mayan villagers in their quest for justice remain. Hud Bay continues to rely on antiquated corporate law concepts to argue in the Canadian court that its corporate head office is not legally responsible for the harms caused by its wholly owned and controlled subsidiary corporation. The lawsuit continues in Ontario courts. And again, check out rightsaction.org. Or chocversushudbay.com. That's chalkversushudbay.com. And you can get more, actually. There's a Defensora. It's a forthcoming feature-length film which documents the Mayan Quechua people's struggle in eastern Guatemala to reclaim their ancestral lands, to promote community development and environmental well-being, and to seek justice and remedy for the murder, shootings, and rapes committed against them by Canadian mining companies in Guatemala. There's also the testimony of Rosa Albira, which is up on YouTube, as well as a quick piece about Canadian nickel mining company Sky Resources or Hud Bay Minerals related illegal forced evictions of indigenous Mayan Quechua communities in eastern Guatemala. We're going with Propaganda, Cut Into the Earth from Potemkin City Limits here on AWOL Radio Smash State Report.
Haven't withered away. If you have been broken, was willing. A monstrous moving across the sea. When she relieved the bones all over the world.
Propaganda here on AWOL Radio, Smash the State Report. We're going to go to a quick little triple set of news from the Daily Gur from Thursday's Immigrant and Labor Justice Edition.
Angry teachers took to social media Saturday to sound off about a surprise late evening statement on Friday from the Ontario Secondary Schools Teachers Federation, recommending its members suspend their political action and resume providing extracurricular activities. The news has created a divide among teachers, many of whom feel that they have been betrayed by their union leadership. Union members were left with no details about the reasoning behind the decision to suspend political action and were informed that a press conference would be held with OSSTF officials this past Monday at 9:30 a.m. to answer all questions. With no comment coming from union leadership, many teachers took to Twitter, Facebook, and other social media to voice their opinion on the matter, questioning union leadership and why the decision to halt all ongoing protests over extracurriculars was voted on by union executives and not by the union membership itself. Some teachers even took to Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne's official Facebook page to voice their anger over the OSSTF decision. I don't trust the new Liberal leadership one bit. Count on many teachers to not return to volunteering at school, as our goodwill has been taken for granted, wrote a teacher with the Thames Valley District School Board near London, Ontario, in response to a post Wynne made that applauded the union's announcement. It continued, "Many of us feel disrespected and undervalued. I have already committed to coaching hockey and soccer outside of school and will not have time to do any more. Don't count on me to come back until a fair contract is in place, one that is negotiated and not imposed on us." OSSTF has sold out members in deal with the Ontario Liberal Party. No collectively bargained agreements, no extracurricular activities, wrote a teacher at Toronto's Western Technical and Commercial School. Michael Jersic, a teacher at Ryerson Community Public School in Toronto, wrote, "Liberals won, teachers zero. Way to divide and conquer, Premier. You sold out your members, OSSTF President Ken Coron." The hashtag NoBackrooms has been created on Twitter to collect angry messages from teachers, directed at the OSSTF and the governing Liberals. Furthermore, We Are the Front Lines in Education, a public forum for teachers and their supporters on Facebook, is also active in helping to spread the teachers' current struggle. In other Ontario schools-related news, it was all about solidarity on Tuesday evening. Teachers joined forces to protest Labor Relations Board application. As the Trillium Lakelands District School Board regular meeting at the Lindsay Education Center office started, more than 250 Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario members from Trillium Lakelands, as well as colleagues from Durham, Toronto, York, Peterborough, and Simcoe, joined forces to protest the local school board's application to the Ontario Labor Relations Board that cites the teachers' pause from voluntary service is illegal. The hearing began on January 25th and ended in the beginning of February, but no decision has yet been reached. Only two school boards in Ontario have gone this route, further angering teachers as to why it is happening. "Things have been difficult enough. We've had problems with the provincial government. As their employers, you would think they would be more supportive rather than putting in an extra kick," said Toronto local president Martin Long of the local school board. "We're in uncharted territory. We need to show support," he said. The move by the local board is also a big reason why members of the Kawartha Pine Ridge local, like Bill Betts, also attended. "The Trillium Lakelands folks have been targeted by their board. It's just the right thing to do," said Mr. Betts. "We've been standing strong against the province's intentional decisions to break our solidarity. It's important we share that same support here." In addition to protesting at the Lindsay office, buses of the teachers also headed to board offices in Haliburton and Bracebridge. Mr. Adams said the decision by the board, which joined forces with the Upper Canada District School Board for the Labour Board application, was the final straw in a struggle that began last spring when talks between public teachers' unions and the province broke down, followed by the introduction of Bill 115, the Putting Students First Act. It takes a lot to make teachers this upset. This Ontario Labour Relations Board application is the perfect example to say enough is enough, he said. Further noting the cost of the whole exercise is mind-boggling. The time and the energy and the money could be spent elsewhere. Moving on, janitors and...
And that was from Thursday's Daily Gur, the Immigrant and Labour Justice Edition. Almost out of time here on the Smash State Report here on AWOL Radio, though we're going to continue the show by playing our interview with Ward Churchill. Just wanted to announce two things here. The first being an awesome, awesome new, or an awesome radio program going on at CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. It's called Indigenous Waves. It's heard every Monday from 4 to 5 p.m. You can listen to it streamed online at ciut.fm. And Indigenous Waves is a celebration of Indigenous cultures locally, nationally, and globally. Through music, storytelling, interviews, panel discussions, art, and humor, we explore the diversity of Indigenous people. And for a little taste, I mean, right now, right on the main page, Taiaki Alfred returns to Indigenous Waves to discuss Idle No More, Wasase, Indigenous Nationhood, and more. And you look just beyond that is Human Rights Watch and Justice for Girls on a report of RCMP abuse of BC Indigenous women. And the list just keeps going on and on. It's a really good program, a really good news program, all focusing on music, storytelling, interviews, panel discussions, art, and humor, and more. Again, check out indigenouswaves.com for more on that. And from mostlywater.org, an urgent fundraising appeal. Mostly Water is produced with 100% all-volunteer labor. The many hours spent each month researching, posting, editing, and occasionally writing articles, as well as a technical support for the site, comes without any payment or remuneration of any kind. However, there are technical-related costs to keep Mostly Water online. For the most part, these costs have been borne personally by our friends in the Resist Collective, but this situation cannot continue. Unfortunately, response to our fundraising request has been much less than we'd hoped. If we cannot raise at least $50 per month, we will have no choice but to discontinue the Mostly Water project. We need at least 10 individuals to donate at least $5 per month on a regular basis to keep Mostly Water operational. You can donate through either of the following methods: through the Resist CEC account, or through payment PayPal or credit card. Check out the Resist donation page, resist.ca/donate. If you become a sustainer, please send your name, email, and method of payment to info@mostlywater.org so you can get a personal thank you and so they can keep track of you. Mostly Water appreciates that these days are especially hard for many people financially. However, if you are able to donate a small amount each month, it would contribute to keeping Mostly Water active and online. In solidarity, Mostly Water. AWOL Radio, that's the Smash the State Report this week. It is March 1st. We're going to go into an interview that AWOL Radio did with Ward Churchill a while ago. Finally getting it out. First, Immigrants and Hypocrites from Star Fucking Hipsters. Smash State Report. We're all immigrants and hypocrites, delusional, and sick fits. Pretend to play a special part, important, pray we fall apart. It's the same game with the same place. We're dying, dreams are strong on press, and never ending.